From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Lawmakers have just 6 legislative days left to debate and pass bills that change the way we do things in Georgia. This week brought continued discussion about a state takeover of Atlanta's airport and intense debate over women's reproductive rights. Here is State Senator Valencia C. during a hearing on the bill, which would make Georgia's laws the most restrictive in the country.
No man can give a birth. So I just do not appreciate consistently hearing common sense as if I don't have common sense. I got enough sense to bring this amendment to try to fix it to no avail.
GPB political reporter Stephen Fowler has been tirelessly covering the bill and the legislative session for us and joins me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Now, one of the most watched bills in front of lawmakers is the so-called heartbeat bill. If passed, would effectively ban abortions in most cases once a heartbeat is detected, so around 6 weeks into pregnancy. What's the latest on this measure?
So, Virginia, today the state Senate is expected to hear the bill on the floor. Now, the Senate is the smaller body, kind of the more august body, so they don't really have as many time limits about debate and things. So I've heard that there's no time limit being set on this debate, which means that senators would have about 30 minutes per senator to discuss this. And so I'd expect this afternoon to be several hours worth of debate over this bill. I'm seeing pictures this morning of lots of Capitol Police lined up outside the Capitol in preparation for a lot of people demonstrating both for and against the bill. And because this was amended in the Senate Science and Technology Committee Monday morning, once the Senate passes it, the bill would have to go back to the House before heading to Governor Brian Kemp's desk.
And on Monday morning, during that Senate and Technology meeting, a substitute version of the bill passed along party and gender lines. What happened?
Well, so the committee was chaired by Republican Renee Unterman. She's one of 2 Republican women in the Senate, and it passed on a vote of 3 men, 3 Republican men, and 2 Democratic women, and they added an ex officio member of the committee to be that third yes vote to make sure that the chair didn't have to vote and that there wouldn't be a tie. And there were some substitutes added to the bill in addition to effectively banning abortion once a heartbeat is detected around 6 weeks. It includes provisions that would allow a mother and father to basically, after conception or after this heartbeat is detected, claim that embryo on their taxes like they would a newborn child, and do other things like count it in the state census population, and added in a measure that a Democrat proposed that would allow child support, that would require a father to pay child support at that 6-week mark.
All right. During the discussion of the bill yesterday on the House floor, Ethics Committee Chairman Randy Nix lectured members about following House rules during debate. Here he is.
I had a number of people come to me following our debate from a couple of weeks ago with concerns about conduct on the floor of the House. This was people from both parties, and there were some people who were concerned about the things that occurred.
Now, this comes after strong protests from House Democrats during a vote on the abortion bill. So what does it mean for a future debate?
So, Virginia, this debate happened on crossover day, which is the day that ended at 11 p.m. on a Thursday. And this was one of the last bills they discussed. It was about an hour in the House. Some House Democrats brought coat hangers with them to symbolize what they say would happen if abortion was legal abortions were effectively ended. One representative had a canister of bleach on her desk. And when the bill's sponsor started speaking, several House Democrats stood up and turned their backs. And all of these things, according to this ethics memo, are against House rules of decorum. And there's now an official on paper document saying that if those were to happen, you know, hypothetically speaking, or in real life, they would violate the House rules, and there could be a $100 fine, or if there's repeated instances or issues, that it could result in the House voting to expel the members. Now, what this actually means for debate remains to be seen, because the Democrats are very passionate about this debate and this bill, and, decorum is one thing, but speaking their mind about this bill is another. So it remains to be seen what happens as far as the debate whenever this bill might come up again in the House.
Stephen, you reported this week a feature about the effort to overturn Roe versus Wade using these heartbeat bills, which is being done in several states, noting that none has been successful so far. So what's different about the Georgia bill that has supporters feeling hopeful?
So, like I mentioned earlier, there are these provisions that don't actually deal with the procedure itself, the tax credit, the counting in the census, the child support. These are the issues related to abortion, but not actually the abortion procedure, that may be what triggers this legal challenge. Other states have passed the heartbeat bill or signed the heartbeat bill. It's been struck down as unconstitutional by the courts because of the specific Supreme Court ruling dealing with the right to have an abortion. But the tax credit or some of the other financial and economic and populational things may be something that supporters feel could be used to be challenged in the court and have this in front of the Supreme Court eventually.
Well, so this is obviously something that's going to be watched and you'll be reporting on. But meanwhile, lawmakers still have to pass the fiscal year 2020 budget. Now, this is the one thing that they are required to approve. $27.5 billion document. One of the biggest sticking points is a pay raise for teachers. The Senate says it will fully fund Governor Kemp's promise of a $3,000 raise. But walk us through how this has played out in the process.
Well, so on the campaign trail, Republican Governor Brian Kemp said that he would give a $5,000 raise for teachers. In his budget proposal, it was $3,000 that he said was a down payment because that's quite a lot of money for quite a lot of people. Now, the House said, we're going to take that $3,000, trim it down a little bit, and add in other certified professionals that work in schools, school psychologists, counselors, things like that, beyond just a classroom teacher. So then, a little bit less money, but more people get it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over on the Senate side, they, you know, moved some things around and said that more people get it, and it's the full $3,000 raise. And with the proposal right now, that would be accomplished by delaying it a few months from, you know, the beginning of the fiscal year to a few months later so that everyone gets that money, and it's a way that makes the books balance out in the budget.
Is it usual to wait this long to pass a budget?
Well, you know, they do have 40 legislative days to pass it, and the first thing they have to do is pass the amended fiscal year budget for any expenses that changed or revenue that changed, and it takes a lot. There are a lot of different subcommittees and different state agencies that have to testify and say, we need this and that. It has to start in the House. They have to have their committees. It has to go to the Senate. They have their committees, and then they have to meet together. So this is the bulk of the lawmakers' time and energy, is figuring out how our tax dollars come in and how they're spent for programs and services and other things that we need.
That's GPB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler. He's been covering this legislative session and reporting back to us on Second Thought. All right, so you mentioned Crossover Day 2 weeks ago. This is when it's widely considered the last day a bill has to pass out of either the House or the Senate to be discussed during the rest of the session. This week, we saw an exception, however, a bill dealing with education. What's the bill and what was the exception?
Well, so the bill is something that the Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan championed that, depending on how you view the issue, it's either school choice or a school voucher program. And the Georgia Senate rejected that bill earlier. And what it would do would have these state-funded accounts that parents could redirect state money that would go towards a public school education into kind of private school money. That rejected, that was failed, but the Lieutenant Governor vowed that he was going to make it happen. So now it's kind of this zombie bill that is being attached to a different bill that already passed the House. That's an education measure, so it's the same part of the code, and that the original bill would restrict the type of organizations that can collect and distribute tax credit funding. So it's kind of related, but it's kind of not. So it's being hijacked to push this school choice, school voucher, or how you want to look at it, bill.
All right. So keeping with the theme of late session shenanigans, we have a bill that would give a tax break for airlines purchasing jet fuel. Now folded into a proposed airport takeover, if I got that right?
Well, so there was an airport takeover bill already passed by the Senate, pushed by rural senators, not in the Atlanta area. And that's still being in the House. It's being heard. No action has been taken on it yet. So the House passed a bill that would codify this tax break for airlines, mainly Delta, but other airlines in Atlanta, that purchase jet fuel in the state. So the Senate took that jet fuel tax break bill and also added the airport takeover language in it. I guess playing this game of chicken with Delta, saying, if you like this tax break, you'll like this. You'll like this takeover. But we'll see. If the House doesn't vote on the airport takeover the first time, they may not vote on it the second time. So, like you said, late session shenanigans going on.
Okay, so rural transit, another issue lawmakers want to address before the end of the session. House Transportation Chairman Kevin Tanner has a bill that would create a new state agency to handle mobility and transit. His aim is boosting the transit in areas across the state. How would that work?
Well, so this bill would create a new state agency that would kind of oversee the transit and transportation. It would create 8 different zones of mobility across the state, one of them already being Atlanta, where we have the ATL, which will be the new name for MARTA and all of the transit things here. Basically, it would take the original version of the bill would take a 50-cent or a 50-cent per ride credit for Uber and Lyft and taxis and things to fund pilot projects for transit. The current version would take sales tax on limousines and transportation as a dedicated funding source for rural transit. But it's getting held up by the Georgia Department of Transportation and others saying, we don't want to solely take all of the transportation and transit things and put it in one agency, because there are 6 different agencies that already oversee transit. So it's being held up by kind of the Atlanta area interest and the rural interest. But what this could do is fix transit, or at least start the process of transit in rural Georgia.
Well, we, of course, both Georgia senators were in town this week with 2 very different thoughts on the White House. Republican Johnny Isakson, a guest on GPB's Political Rewind with Bill Nygut, had some pretty harsh criticism for President Trump's recently revived criticism of the late Senator John McCain. But also yesterday, Republican David Perdue was with the Vice President Mike Pence at an Atlanta Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility. Let's hear a little from that.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the men and women who enforce our laws, do not inflict misery. They bring safety and security to the people of Atlanta, and they deserve the respect of every elected official in this country.
Kind of an affront against Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, who has said that we're not going to house immigrants or cooperate with ICE in Atlanta. So what's the message there?
Well, you know, this was a trip that the vice president made to campaign with David Perdue, but also to stop by Homeland Security and ICE in Atlanta and say, I appreciate the job that you're doing. He said that the Atlanta field office is one of the busiest in the country, and said that in the last 2 years that that agency and that field office removed about 14,000 non-citizens from the U.S. And yeah, it was a pretty big slap in the face, so to speak, to the mayor for saying that ICE, she would no longer work with them. And so we'll see if the mayor has anything to say about that today.
Well, we're going to hear a lot more about that. Today's Political Rewind is going to be a 2. It's going to have an extended update on Georgia politics. And the team was on hand yesterday for the vice president's visit. So you'll hear more today at 2. You can also watch on Facebook Live for Political Rewind. Stephen Fowler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
GPB Stephen Fowler. Find him most days at the state capitol, definitely today, helping to make sense of the legislative session. Now, coming up, an effort to protect endangered fish in the Savannah River could be a problem for waterfront property. We'll explore the debate. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more of On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The annual PBS Kids Writing Contest is underway. The deadline is Friday, March 29th. It's for children in kindergarten through third grade. They're invited to submit both stories and illustrations, and the winning stories air on GPB TV. We're going to be bringing some of those highlights during On Second Thought. 2 Georgia children's book writers are helping to inspire kids. Aisha Saeed is author of Bilal Cook's Doll. Laurel Snyder's books include The King of Too Many Things and Charlie and Mouse. First, here's Aisha talking about her inspiration.
I've been writing my entire life, and it's been the way that I make sense of the world, and it's how I find my creativity outlet. So it's been something I've done since I was a small child. My parents would take me to the library every week, and so that's what spurred my love for wanting to write. I just wrote for fun. I wrote for myself. I didn't know that I could be an author. The fact that I was writing books and completing them, that always made me an author.
I've pretty much always been a writer, as long as I can remember. I wrote poems and stories and ultimately books by the time I was about 8 or 9 years old. The most important thing books have done in my life is they've kept me company. And so I feel like that's my goal with my writing, that I want the characters and the storylines to make kids feel less alone. I think that one of the really, really powerful things about writing is this creative and sort of critical thinking skills that you develop as a writer are useful in everywhere. Learning the building blocks of writing and sort of communicating well. Those kids go on to be writers and better communicators in other parts of their lives.
The thing that I loved most about writing when I was young was being able to be creative. Because on that page, I could do anything. I could create new worlds. I could create new characters. And it was so fun to explore. And as an adult, I still love to do that. I still love to explore a new setting or a new place.
With each book, I paint all of the characters. I paint a map of the place where they live to try and explore what this world looks like in a way that is different than writing. It's like it reminds you that this is a relaxing, fun, creative imagination thing. You're not always illustrating the thing that you told. You might be illustrating the thing you didn't tell. There might be a whole world in your head and only some of the things came out in the writing, and so the art allows you to fill in the holes.
Illustrations help bring a book to life. They help the reader to imagine more clearly what you were thinking as you were writing the book. And it's a great way to keep a reader really interested and wanting to just keep on reading more. I think writing and storytelling and using your imagination is really important because it's a way to unpack your thoughts about things and to explore how you feel about things. I know when I was younger, I could put out things that maybe I couldn't say out loud, but I could put them onto a page.
Writing is about you. And it can be other things, but it's really about you by yourself and what's inside you. So I have very vivid memories, both in elementary school and then in high school, of what it felt like to be a part of something like this contest. It isn't about winning. That's not the point. It's about outlet and community. Kids can see examples of other children out there who are doing this kind of stuff that they're doing, and they feel like there are other people out there like me. I think that a context like this can give kids a reason to shoot for something more. It's not just fun and play, and it's not a grade. It's something in the middle. It's, we're gonna work at this, we're gonna make it better, we're gonna make the story as good as it can be. But you can't fail this assignment.
When I was young, I also entered writing contests myself, and I think the hardest part about writing is that you want it to be the best that it can be, and when you start writing a book, it's going to be a little messy and rough because it's all your ideas on the page. So I usually start with a little bit of an outline where I kind of write down the things that might be in the story, what might be interesting, and what I want to explore. Then I go ahead and write a first draft, and the first draft is never going to be the final version, and you revise and revise until you feel like that you have written the very best possible version of that you can. And I've written many books now, but every single time I still have those same fears, and I know that it's normal to have those fears, and you just have to work through them because you will get to the end and you will get to the draft that you want.
Above my desk, there's a little piece of paper that says, you can fix it later. It's really, really important to remember that you can always go back and fix the punctuation or the spelling or decide that you want to change somebody's name or add a sentence that makes it better. But what you don't want to do is slow yourself down so that you don't let yourself tell the story.
I think all children have amazing things within them that they can share with us through stories. And the fact that you wrote this story, that you took the courage to send it in, I think that's a huge achievement just into itself and something to be proud of. After you finish submitting this story for this contest, I hope that you keep writing stories because your voice matters and the world needs to hear it.
The last voice you heard there was children's book author Aisha Saeed. You also heard from Laurel Snyder. They and all of us are encouraging kids to participate in the PBS Kids Writing Contest. You can find more information at gpb.org/education. And now to a very grown-up story. Families share genetic traits and often share pain, secrets, and trauma. Anissa Gray writes about how those are carried in her debut novel, The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls. Anissa is senior editor at CNN Worldwide and recipient of the DuPont Columbia University Award for Journalism. The Atlanta-based author joins me now to talk about the new book. Hello, Anissa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. But this book, it is definitely grown up, opens with a sobering jail scene, and we learn that one of the main characters, Althea, gets arrested with her husband, Proctor. They're convicted of running a scam charity, sentenced to prison for several years. I'm curious why you chose this particular crime for the storyline.
Althea and her husband are convicted of fraud. It's a white-collar crime, and for a lot of people, white-collar crimes don't feel quite as bad. And that's the case for Althea. She sees what she did as a victimless crime when, of course, it's not. It's a crime that touches the lives of her neighbors and people who viewed her as a friend. It's a crime of betrayal. And I was interested in exploring what that says about Althea and her husband and what it looks like to come back from that, if it's possible to come back from that. And I'll stop here before I reveal any spoilers.
Right. Well, so in this case, Althea and Proctor, both the husband and wife, go to jail, and their children are left behind. You recently wrote a news article about the separation from children from their moms due to incarceration. So had you done a lot of reporting and research on this issue before writing the book?
I had not. I hadn't done any reporting at all on the topic. It was my research for the book, in fact, that informed my desire to write the article about mothers in prison and how that impacts their children. As you can imagine, a mother's absence can take quite a toll, including putting their kids at higher risk of ending up in prison themselves. For the article, I looked at some innovative programs that are trying to preserve the mother-child bond during incarceration, including one incredible program up at Rikers Island in New York, that it lets female inmates spend time with their children outside of jail at a children's museum. And it's all part of the broader efforts we're seeing in the direction of criminal justice reform. So, yeah, this was the book sort of opened the door for me to explore this topic further in a nonfiction format.
And each chapter is told from the perspectives of each of the three sisters, Althea, Viola, and Lillian. I just read it. I don't know how you say those.
No, you're doing great.
But, you know, they all lost their mother, too, at a young age. So there's like the specter of the missing mother there. But I'm curious about the process for character development, making sure each of these voices stood out in distinct ways. How did you do that?
Most of the characters sort of came to me fully formed, Viola most especially. Some elements of Viola's story are elements of my own. She's actually the character I started out with, and she has an eating disorder, and that sort of mirrors some of my own treatment for an eating disorder. So she was somewhat distinct in my mind and came sort of fully formed. Lillian as well, the youngest sister. Althea was a much more difficult nut to crack. Part of it was, the fact that she'd committed a crime. So it took me writing her a lot, some of it which, you know, doesn't end up on the page. The reader never sees, but I see it, and it helped me to get to know her. And I tried to simulate that a little bit in the book, on the page. I think out of all of the characters, Althea is the one where you see this sort of more deliberate pulling back of layers until you get a clearer picture of exactly who she is. And that's kind of how she came to me as the writer.
Well, the book, the title is The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls, and eating disorders do play a big role in this. As you said, Viola, she's an eating disorder therapist. She's recovering herself. And there's this an estimation that 30 million people suffer from an eating disorder in the U.S. So what were you exploring there, Anissa?
Well, sort of broadly speaking, in the novel, I think at the heart of it, there's an examination of the many hungers that drive us, right, whether for good or for bad. With Viola, it manifests through a literal eating disorder. Althea, for another example, experiences a sense of emptiness that becomes apparent through a kind of grasping need, and we see that manifested through her crimes. So taken together, you have all of these women who've endured losses. You mentioned the loss of their mother and betrayals, which are inherent in Althea's crime, and each one is trying to fill those hollow places in some highly dysfunctional ways. So I think that's sort of the broader message in the book, and that is sort of what's behind the title itself.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the eating disorder, you know, anorexia, yeah, the denial of hunger. So that plays out in here, too, in a way. You have to make yourself not need something that's missing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so much of it's all about the family. They have their own personal issues and circumstances, but they take care of each other and their twin nieces when their sister is in jail. So what were your thoughts as you're writing about these complicated sibling relationships? Do you come from a family of sisters?
I do. In fact, I have three sisters. And
funnily enough,
yeah, I'm actually one of five kids. I have one brother and three sisters, all of whom I love dearly. But we have our moments with each other, and depending on the issue at hand, different factions can form. And yet we remain a sort of cohesive gang of four with respect to my sisters and my brother as well. So given my own life and experiences, this was sort of a natural thing for me to write about and draw at least some of what I know of family and some of what I know of sibling relationships.
That's Anissa Gray. Her debut novel is The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls. She's an Atlanta-based author and also a journalist. So you do have this background in storytelling. But how about writing fiction for you? What was that transition like?
Well, you're certainly using some of the same muscles in journalism and fiction writing, creativity and understanding of storytelling structure and pacing. But for me, sort of journalism, having been a journalist for the entirety of my career, it also affects how I work as a fiction writer, in that I view writing of all kinds as work, which means I'm pretty good about setting a schedule, and I have a healthy respect for deadlines.
Hmm.
So it influences how I work as a novelist.
Well, and you've reported on so many people, so you've heard a lot of voices. You've heard people talk about how these issues, be they criminal, political, rule-breaking, law-abiding, learning how people speak. Do you think that helps you? How did that help you?
I think it helps a lot. I mean, some of that certainly comes through my job, but just in general, by temperament, I tend to be a person who listens more than she speaks. So when you are observant in that way, you hear a lot of stories. You hear the cadence of different voices. So it is, and then you go back and you sit at your desk, and all of that is sort of sitting there and resting in your mind, and it informs how it informs what you do. I think it makes at least me, it helps me tune my ear to dialogue.
Well, to writing
dialogue.
The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls is your debut novel, and a lot of praise, a lot of anticipation, and it's being compared to Britt Bennett's The Mothers in an American Marriage by Tayari Jones. Some good company there. In fact, somebody called it The Mothers Meets an American Marriage.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'll take that.
So, but why do you think these kind of stories are so in tune? Why are they speaking to people right now?
Well, I mean, we all come from somewhere, right? We all, this, my book is a book about family, and it's about how traumas can be handed down sort of from one generation to the next, and sort of what happens at a moment of departure when you're given an opportunity to do something different, to change course. And that's where we find the characters here. And I think, we can all sort of see ourselves in a lot of these stories. In these family stories, in these sibling stories, I think we see a lot of reflections of ourselves.
Mm. Are you thinking about writing more novels, working on a next project?
I am. I'm actually working on another project now. It's also about family, but a much smaller family. It's about what happens when the father goes missing.
Atlanta-based author Anissa Gray, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the novel and all of the great reception it's had. So debut novel of Anissa Gray is The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls, and available online and, of course, and on store shelves. Now, we're going to explore how accents affect people's perceptions of Southerners. This is part of a conversation we started a couple weeks ago with Laura Relier, who wrote about trying to lose her accent. Got a lot of response. A lot of people weighed in and talked about their relationships with their accents. So we're going to go that much further with this perception of Southerners. We'd love you to join the conversation. We're on our Facebook group, GPB Radio's On Second Thought. You can also comment on Twitter at OST Talk. Email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org, and we'll try to incorporate your comments. And as always, if you missed any of the show, if you want to listen on your own time, go to the Programs tab at gpbnews.org. Go to On Second Thought, and you can subscribe to the On Second Thought podcast so you won't miss conversations like this, and you can help us seed other ones. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us. We've got a short break, and we'll be back with more On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few weeks back, we talked with Bitter Southerner contributor Laura Relier, who told us about trying to lose her Southern accent when she moved to Chicago as a kid and then reclaiming it as an adult. We heard from a lot of you about your relationship to Southern accents and the experience of being thought of as a hick. This was a stereotype made popular by shows like the Beverly Hillbillies.
This here is the Clampett place. I'm Jed Clampett, my young and Ellie Mae, and Granny. Granny says you've been doing some wildcatting.
There's no need to. Mr. Clampett, that swamp of yours is full of oil.
I could have told you that.
Well, my company would like to pump it out.
Yeah, I'd like that too, but I just can't afford to have it done.
So today we are digging further into the persistent myth of the dumb Southerner with Marie Cochran. She's director of the Afrolatcha Artist Project, wrote about growing up African-American in Appalachia for Rewired.News, and she's joining me on the line. Marie, welcome.
Glad to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to have you with us. Also with us, Chuck Reese, host of the Bitter Southerner podcast on GPB, editor of the Bitter Southerner magazine. Chuck, great to have you back with us.
Always glad to be here.
So, Chuck, for you, the Beverly Hillbillies broadcast image of dim-witted white Southerners, 1962-71, dated, certainly, but why so indelible?
Well, for me, it's hard not to think of it as indelible because I grew up with it. I was born in 1961, and it's one of the earliest television shows I remember watching. But, you know, I didn't really know too many people like Jed and Granny, you know, and even though I grew up in a small rural town, if anything, we had a little more in common with the Mayberry of the Andy Griffith Show, which is, you know, arguably the pioneering show of you know, what I refer to now as hillbilly TV. But, you know, that is a trope about the South that has never gone away since the advent of television. I mean, it comes all the way up through things like Duck Dynasty.
Right, and Dukes of Hazzard, Hee-Haw, all that kind of thing. How about for you, Marie? Did you ever see families that looked or acted like yours in media growing up?
Well, first of all, I have to say that you paired us perfectly because I was born in 1962.
Perfect.
All right.
In Toccoa, Georgia. And so these are parts of my childhood. And, you know, the first paragraph that I put in my essay was that I simultaneously had a crush on John Boy of the Waltons and Michael of Good Time.
So
the thing was, I had pretty much to see reflections of myself in those two different shows that didn't adequately reflect what my experience was. But just piggybacking on what Chuck said, also, my favorite shows for entertainment were Soul Train and Hee Haw.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
At the same time.
Well, and Marie, you also write in your piece about what happens when you introduce yourself as a person from Appalachia. So what kind of responses do you get?
All right, here we go. If they're white folks, even some people who don't know me, who meet me, they'll ask me where I'm from. And then they'll ask me, okay, but how long have you lived here? And I said, I was born and raised in Stevens County. Then if they're black friends of mine from wherever, but specifically, let's say, Atlanta, they'll say, oh, you're the only family there.
Mm.
And that's how it was when I grew up. And unfortunately, that's still the way it is now.
Well, Chuck, this is something that you also came up against when you were working in a magazine in New York City. You know, how do people respond when they heard your accent from the South? Not that we're going to get to the race thing in just a second.
Well, when I first moved to New York City to go to work for Adweek magazine in 1984, anytime anyone heard me talk, I mean, you can't go to New York with a twang like mine and not be made fun of, you know. I did find it interesting after a while because, you know, I was up there the first time I lived there for 5 years, and you learn how to adapt. But I adapted while keeping my accent because I just couldn't get rid of it. I mean, you know, the only place I would ever try is when I was ordering a bagel or a sandwich at a deli, because it seemed to help if I tried to talk a little faster, you know, plain bagel, toasted schmear.
I'm not convinced. Yeah, please do.
Yeah, because I'm glad that you talked about the whole idea of leaving our home, our rural communities, to go to urban communities, because even as you were asking me about, you know, how people reacted to finding out that I was from, you know, the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, they didn't believe me because I don't have the twang.
Hmm.
And so it's not even about just the issue of race. I mean, I didn't try to get rid of it. I listen to a lot of public television, and I blame Mr. Rogers. And I wish I had the twang. So, you know, this whole, you know, sort of interweaving between expectations and reality, I think is really what Chuck and I, you know, are dealing with in the work that we do.
Yeah, so, but you write, Marie, I'm a black Southerner, and my experience, while it defies the white hillbilly stereotype, is assuredly Appalachian. Do you think Appalachian reads white?
Always.
Yeah,
but
you
not,
do?
Not always forever because of the word Afrolatcha. When Frank X. Walker and the group of Kentucky writers have not only, you know, put it in the dictionary and won various awards and created these incredible careers. But when I met Frank X. Walker 8 years ago in Asheville, North Carolina, I asked him, I said, you know, what's going on? At the time, they were, you know, blowing up. The Carolina Chocolate Drops had, you know, were performing. They hadn't won the Grammy yet. I met them before, they became famous.
You knew them when.
I knew him when, but the thing was, you know, I asked him about visual art, and he said, do something with visual art, and that's why I created this network of creatives. But the thing is, you know, all of that is changing with this new generation of professionals and, you know, activists and, you know, people who really just know what their lived experience is. Because I didn't, you know, even say this, but, you know, I would assume, and this is something I'm going to explore, that my white friends, you know, were watching Soul Train too, and mm-hmm. because they sure were listening to Bill Rice, Mr. Rice, the Rice Man, play his soul, you know, radio show on Saturdays on WNEG. So people don't acknowledge the back and forth. They acknowledge that the banjo has African roots, but they don't talk about these lived experiences that we have.
Well, as director of the Afrolatcha Artist Project, you connect, support artists of color to keep the history of this region alive. You mentioned the band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops. So here's just a little bit of their song, Cornbread and Butter Beans.
Cornbread and butter beans, and you across the table, eating them beans and making love.
So, Marie, what do you think the history of black Appalachian artists and residents not generally part of the story told about the region?
It doesn't fit a commercial perspective. And I think Chuck, again, could, you know, echo this. We have edited out the good stuff. And, you know, we really have to talk, because it is complicated. It's layered, and sometimes it's, you know, contradicts itself. Dixie, as a song, was written by black people. Now, we won't even get into that, but I'm just dropping it in so your readers and listeners, listeners can go back and look it up. But when the Carolina Chocolate Drops performed on stage, they would do these little interludes and give out that information, because not everybody goes to college and gets a PhD in anthropology or cultural studies. And we need to get the word out.
That's absolutely right, you know, because there's, if you look back into the history of Appalachia, even though there was the de facto racial segregation, there was also de facto racial integration in places too.
Right.
And you hear it most in the music. And when you dig back into the history of that Appalachian string band music, what you realize is that it was something that was created by Scots-Irish immigrants and by African-American people.
Poor people.
Poor people. It's poor people's music. And, you know, even though you might be a white kid who grows up in Appalachia listening to bluegrass music and you think that the banjo is a bluegrass instrument, it's the white man's instrument, but it's not. And once you learn that, you start making connections that you didn't. And that's, you know, I think that's the thing that is true no matter what part of the South's troublesome history you look at. You find, when you really dig in, you find more places where we were together across the racial barriers than you were probably aware of before. And to go back to your point, Marie, yeah, those were my two entertainment shows, Hee-Haw and Soul Train, and that's why to this day I still have a stack of Stylistics, Harold Melvin,
yes,
and the Blue Notes, and OJ's 45s on my shelf.
Uh-huh. And I love Dolly Parton, and I love Buck Owens, and, you know, as much. I mean, and, you know, we're putting a lot of information out there, and I hope, you know, I'm just loving the conversation. But when I moved to North Carolina, because I had these feelings that something wasn't really being explained well. I mean, I always thought, okay, my Atlanta friends, you know, aren't quite getting me. You know, my, you know, other friends might think that, okay, where we're from is backward, and isn't it grand that I'm a UGA grad and I went to the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, and, you know, I've left these humble beginnings, but it's my home. But when I went and got a job in North Carolina, I met Jeff Biggers, and I'm looking at his book right now, The United States of Appalachia, because that's really what I riffed off of when I wrote the essay. And it says how Southern mountaineers brought independence, culture, and enlightenment to America. And when I read this book that told me that Nina Simone, Bill Withers, et cetera, were from my region, and then later met Frank X. Walker, it all came together for me. It really did.
I want to just pick up and tell listeners, we're listening to Marie Cochran. She's from the Afrolatia Artist Project. Chuck Reese is also with us from the Bitter Southerner. Terrific comment here on, let's see, our Facebook page or on Twitter. Leonard Henry says, for dumb Southerners, we certainly lead the rest of the country in the number of excellent writers we produce. We also lead the country in Medal of Honor recipients. My wife was placed in a remedial class in New York City as a child because she was stereotyped for her Southern accent. But what they didn't appreciate, being rather narrow-minded, was that she was the granddaughter of one of America's most famous poets and a genius. So we're talking about the artistic tradition. You were talking about music just then, but also literary tradition. So I'm just wondering, you know, for you, Chuck, you're an editor of the Bitter Southerner magazine, so you're trying to expand the definition of how people think about the South. But at the same time, you know, how do you make distinctions? You know, if somebody comes to you and says, like, I don't know, something prototypically old Southern seeming, about whether you propagate that or you give it attention, or you're just saying, like, this is part of it all. I'm not quite sure what that question is, but I wonder if you can pick up on it.
I think so. You know, I think the thing that, well, the thing that I have definitely found over the 5.5 years we've been publishing this thing is that people, there's this phenomenon that's happening all across the South and has been happening for a good many years now, which is that our region is full of people in cities who live city kinds of lives. You know, Atlanta in many ways is indistinguishable from anywhere else that has hipster coffee shops.
Big metropolitan area, yeah.
These cities are populated by so many of us who grew up with distinctly rural roots.
Right.
We may not have done the thing that so many Southerners have done and left the region for good, but, you know, if we're still here, we come to the city and our minds expand and we start looking at the world in different ways. And, you know, if somebody comes up to me with some old South stuff today, I kind of just write it all off,
mm-hmm.
because so much of it is based on things that we were taught in the public schools. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that the original sin of the South was slavery, right? Another second wave original sin was we spent 100 years teaching our children that we did not fight a war over slavery.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Which was a lie. I mean, we were literally all taught, you know, I hear countless stories, I've heard them ever since we started, of people, you know, saying that when they chose slavery on a high school quiz as the cause of the Civil War, they got an X on mm-hmm. their answer,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's just the truth. And, you know, the thing that really brought that home to me in a big way was an essay that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote immediately after the shootings at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston a few years ago. And in that piece, he quoted from several of the Confederate States' secession declarations, including Georgia's. You don't have to read more than a paragraph into any of those things to find out that the war was really fought over the ability of the states to hold slaves. It's clear, and no one had ever put that document in front of me in any public school class or in any history class at the University of Georgia. I read it for the first time when I was 54.
And I want to add something to what Chuck just said.
Yeah, and Marie, we'll have to wrap soon, so if you can pull it to
I'll
a close.
I'll make that real quick. I just got back from the Appalachian Studies Association conference in Asheville, and they showed the new documentary called Hillbilly. Everybody in that room cried, including me.
Why?
Because it hit home in so many ways. As we said earlier, these acts that have happened through public education or, you know, elected officials meant to divide poor people. Because ultimately, when these poor people come together, they make music, they make babies, they make community. You know, all of these things happen. And, you know, we could go into all kinds of theories about, you know, the whys of that, but we need to really come together because we have so much in common, and that's the richness of the South.
You know what? I'm going to vote that we extend this conversation on another day. I would love to pick it back up. We've got so much more to talk about, but Marie Cochran
nice
and Chuck
meet
Reese.
You, Chuck.
Thank you, Marie.
Great.
I'll send you a hillbilly T-shirt.
All righty.
That's it for today. Have a great weekend. This is On Second Thought.